pre-war trading partners. In this context, Zeiger concludes, Americans increasingly came to couple their horror of the European catastrophe with the appreciation of the opportunities for profit and longer-range economic benefits that the war now offered. As we know, Wilson's attempts to mediate the war failed, and with the Germans' renewal of submarine warfare, America entered the war on the behalf of the Democratic Allies in 1917. The American contribution to the defeat of Germany was substantial. The First World War showed, above all else, that 20th-century warfare was an economic struggle as much as it was a political struggle. America's potent economy provided the Allies with munitions, equipment, foodstuffs, and immense financial resources. The U.S. Navy played an important role in turning back the German submarine menace, and the huge influx of American troops was a key factor in blunting Germany's spring offensives and, especially, in the victorious Allied advance in the crucial summer of 1918. True, only 120,000 Americans died during their country's abbreviated participation in the Great War, but there is little doubt that without American manpower, Europe faced at least an additional year of war. Drawing on the explosion of recent scholarship on the First World War, Robert Zeiger offers the reader a powerful narrative and analysis of the international events that led to America's entry into the war and its profound consequences on the American home front. Zeiger weaves a masterful narrative and interpretation of the effects of the war on progressive reform, racial and gender relations, civil liberties, labor and industry, and the emergence of America as a world power. Zeiger's handling of these issues is skillful and richly informative, providing his readers with an opportunity to evaluate this traumatic event that left America and the world transformed. In doing so, Zeiger invites readers to address the larger problems of nationalism and internationalism, ethnic and religious conflict and tolerance, and intervention and non-intervention in the 21st century. Donald T. Critchlow. Preface and Acknowledgements. My grandfather, Alf Harmon, was one of the last casualties of the Great War. On November 7, 1918, amid the false armistice celebrations that gripped New York that day, the horse drawing the delivery cart he was negotiating through the streets of Manhattan shied and pitched him out. His head struck a street rail and his skull was fractured. He died the next day. Shortly after Alf's death, his daughter, Grace, met my father, John. He had emigrated from Germany in 1912. As a schoolboy, he once saw the Kaiser. During the Great War, he was an enemy alien in New York City, looking for work, barred from going near the waterfront. In 1921, Grace Harmon and John Zeiger were married, affecting their own Anglo-German rapprochement, and went to live with my grandmother, Elizabeth Harmon. In the years after the next World War, I remember vividly the exchanges between my grandmother and father, triggered by some item in the news. Having emigrated from England as a young woman in 1888, she was, I think, always a little unsettled by the presence in the household of this German who had married her daughter. Although he was a thoroughgoing Anglophile who despised even pre-Hitler German political culture, my father could not help twitting her about some folly of the royal family or some evidence of British imperial decline. But she invariably trumped him with, "There'll always be an England," and I believe that he hoped she was right. My father was convinced that had he stayed in Germany, he would surely have been among the 1.7 million of his countrymen killed in the Great War. His words to this effect, expressed so often and so casually as to have become a kind of family joke, came home to me powerfully in April 1995, when my wife, Gay, and I discovered one of the many German military cemeteries scattered about the countryside near Verdun.